One thing about roles before I leave that, I was part of one of the questions I turned on in the surety column here. I'm going to turn it off now, but I'll show you in the process how I did it. Right click to choose show columns, and sureties is one of those. Does anybody use sureties? Good for you. Surety values are ways in which you can evaluate the surety or reliability of your data as you're entering. And you can say the date is more reliable than the place, and the memo is less reliable, whatever. And it's associated, of course, with your source, but it's your evaluation. I need to do this way. Oops. Tag box.
It didn't click.
No, all I did was apply. This is the kind of bug we wrestle with all the time. When I right-clicked and chose Show Columns, Sureties, it turned on Sureties here, but it didn't turn it on for the names. Likewise, when I tried to turn it off, it turned it off for these, but it didn't turn it off for names. Whereas if you go to Preferences, it turns them both on and off. So I made a note of that. Okay, roles. On the master list of roles, there's now options for import and export. Okay, end of subject. It's more complicated than that, but if you have created a bunch of custom event types and or custom roles, and maybe their sentences, you can copy them all out to a file, just those characteristics, not your data, just the administrative stuff, the tag types, the roles, sentences, and the other characteristics of the tag types. Then you can send them to somebody else or upload them to a website and they can import them. Just as you could do with sources, now you can do with tag types.
How do you do that?
On the add menu, you go down to add tag or get to the tag type list, any of the three ways I described. If you have the button still on the screen, you can go straight to it. And then down here are buttons for import and export. So if I want to export them, you know, there are this kind of list in various places through TMG. You've got check marks over there. You can double click on it to turn the check mark on and off. Or you can highlight it and click on mark and unmark. Anyway, once I've chosen those that I want to include in my export, I click on export and it'll ask me what file it's taken as. You get a single file that you can then attach to an email and send it to your friends. Okay. It exports everything about those tag types, including roles, sentences, the restrictions about what, how old the person should be, what sex they should be, how it's exported to GEDCOM, what color it displays that, all the characteristics of the tag types. Okay. Add person. I know a lot of people want to be able to do this. When you need to add a person who's not already in the project, and that's important. Well, I should say not already in the data set. In your regular programs, you talk about the differences between data sets and projects. Should I leave time to talk about that later? You had a whole meeting about it. Good. Okay, so anyway, I should have said data set. When you add a person to the data set, you do it with this button up here. If you want to link somebody to a marriage and they're already in the data set, you don't do it this way because they're already in the data set. So you just go to a marriage and pick them from a list. You can pop up the pick list and choose them. This is literally adding a person that doesn't already exist to the project, to the data set. Most of this is the way it always was in version 7, and it's based on where you are when you summon this feature. I was on John Alexander number 10, so when I add a person that's going to be in relation to John Alexander, his son, his daughter, his wife, brother, sister, father, mother, if I choose something like brother of John Alexander, it will make the links automatically to the new person and these parents of John, so that you don't have to manually do that. You don't have to add a person and then manually create the links to the parents, or conversely, for son, it will ask you who's the mother. If you know it, you can pick it from the list of likely candidates, including all the people that John was married to or ever divorced from or ever had other children with and things like that. It'll give you a list to pick from, or you can say, I don't know, and pick somebody else. But most of these buttons, again, are relative to who I was on, and they show up here in the middle. Unrelated, it just means that you're adding a person who has nothing to do with John, or at least I don't know about it yet. In every case, you're going to get to the Add Person screen. In this case, it's a male. This is the Add Person screen, which has been in there in version 7. And it has elements for a couple of different tags. The name tag, the information about the person's name, his birth, and his death. That's the default, but there's this button down here in the bottom left called Setup, where I can add other event types here, other fields for the existing event types. I can turn on and off things like surety levels and flags and other things. But the advantage of doing that is everything I want to add is in one place. So the real strength to this feature, you could just add John Smith, born 1825, and be done. Of course, you'd want to add your source citation. But the real advantage to this type of screen is that you can customize it for the source type you're working from. So if you're going through a marriage, a church register of marriages or births and baptisms, you can customize these fields to be those that are recorded in that register. Not only the event types, but the labels, and minimize your navigating around or having to add things later. You add one source citation to that church record, that church volume, and that citation is applied automatically to all the different event types on this screen, to his name as well as his birth and death in this case, or you might have a baptism, whatever. So this is the standard Add Person screen, and I went all through that because there are parallels to the new feature which I'm about to talk about. And you get that the same way, you click to add a new person, but down here you click either new family or multiple people of this type. So let's do this first. Add multiple people of this type. Having checked that, I can now still click on any of these buttons, but I'm going to get a different kind of screen. So I'm going to add multiple brothers to John, because I'm going through a will, and it says, you know, John's father, and it says I leave this to my sons, whatever. So I can add multiple brothers all at the same time, and it gives me this sort of spreadsheet. I'm going to resize it for this projector. Spreadsheet data entry, which those of you who date back to it, I think UFT had something similar to this, right? Not as powerful as this, but the same idea, being able to add multiple people at once. So here, each brother of John is going to be a line on this sort of spreadsheet. And so now the fields are laid out horizontally. Name, title, his given name, surname, and I can scroll over to the right since I have this big screen resolution. I have to scroll a lot, but you probably will be able to see more of the columns. And I add his birth date and his city, and these restrictions are the same as you have on the tag entry screen. So the birth date field is going to interpret this value as a date. You can have it as just a year if that's all you know. You don't, of course, have to enter anything at all, but if you enter B1812, it'll understand that that means before 1812 and that sort of thing. There was name, here's birth, and then there's death, and you keep scrolling over to the right, you see all the different columns. I think these are the same columns we were just looking at in the vertical alignment, but of course, a little harder to see in this context, and you probably don't need all of these fields. So as before, there's a setup button down here. And This list on the left are the ones that are selected. These are the ones that are going to show up on the list. And when you highlight one of these, you have a bunch of options for the different fields down below. So if I don't want the name variation title, which is what that first column is, I highlight name variation and uncheck title. And when I save this screen, now I don't have a title column. And so on. You probably want to get it down to surname, given name, maybe birth date, if that's all you're working with in the particular source. So let's just enter the home button on my keyboard here. Henry. Oops. I tell him I'm getting used to my new keyboard. Now it's all caps.
Do you use parallels?
I do, yeah. I'm using parallels. So I entered Henry. I could go over here to the birth date and say, well, let's use something realistic. So he was born in 1812. That was a good guess. So let's say he was born in 1813. That's all I know. I can now down arrow or enter, and it will drag me down through multiple people. And I can add as many as I want here. George. Robert. Now, I have a flag, sex flag here, which I could actually change, even though I said I was adding multiple brothers. And if you don't enter a name for the person, they won't be added. So you can leave a line blank. That's okay. The ID numbers are going to be assigned to the people who are listed here. The reference number, if you use that, listed here. Again, you can disable those columns. What are now columns used to be rows in the other setup through the setup button. Well, 1813, let's say this is 1814, this is 1815. And click well, I'm gonna add my source location, of course. And let's just say it's the Barnes Bible. Happens to be what I call it. I'm not going to enter anything else. Now, when I save this, I've got six pieces of data, three names and three birth tags. And each of those six is going to have a citation to the Barnes Bible. Click on OK. Bing, bang, boom. It's done. It leaves me on the last one, but I could always just back arrow to get back to John. And now you see John has these siblings that he didn't have. Right, so John had a lot of siblings. Two of them born in 1814. So that's the shorthand lesson for that feature. Add multiple people. Let me add multiple sons. Normally, if you're going to add multiple sons or daughters, they are full sons and daughters, not stepsons. They're full siblings, I should say, not stepbrothers, half-brothers, half-sisters. So you pick a woman for the other parent, or if they're not always the same parent, you would choose none and add them as appropriate later to the individuals. You can just, again, add as many people as you want here. And what was the other point? There's this import button down here, which some people are asking about. And this is very handy. It's not a beginner kind of feature, but if you have an existing database in a spreadsheet somewhere, or if you just find it easier to work with Excel, you can do your data entry just like this, rows and columns, in Excel, and then click on import and import that file. From Excel, you want to export it as a comma-separated file, CSV file, but then you just pick it from the list and it will populate this list from your spreadsheet. So there are a lot of people, I still get calls regularly from people who never used the genealogy software before, they've done everything in Excel and they decided to finally move over it. This is a godsend form because it just sucks it all in at once.
Okay, Bob?
Yes.
Before you bring it in that Excel sheet, you should have the same column set up here.
Yes. You should set up the screen you're importing to so that it matches your spreadsheet. Yeah. Now, this is multiple sons here when I went into this. So if I import a spreadsheet with 400 people on it, John's going to have 400 siblings or whoever I started from. So that actually gets to the other element of this. Instead of, well, you could say add multiple people unrelated. That's probably how you want to do it if you're importing a huge spreadsheet of people. The one thing it doesn't do is make any connections between the various people in those rows, because you said they're unrelated. And some people who, let me know, we can talk about it later, if you're one of those who has a bunch of data in a spreadsheet, typically what people do is they'll say person number 3 here is the same as person number 7 there, and that's just not something you can automate. But, or worse, they'll just say John Smith down here, which is obviously the same John Smith as the one over here, and that never works. Anyway, a list of unrelated people or a list of people who are of a particular relationship, you can enter in the spreadsheet if that's easier for you, and then import them. The feature down here is for a new family, which has not only those columns that we've been seeing, but it also has this relation field. So I've got a father, and then once I've entered him, I go down and I can add the mother, and then I can add children, each one, you know, sons or daughters or whatever. So here I may be taking data off a family group sheet that somebody sent me or a website or something else. Again, you specify the columns that are important to you so that you can minimize all the tabbing around and so on. You add all the people and their role to the family. You enter one source citation for that document you're drawing from, and you click on OK, and you're done. So it really cuts down dramatically the time it takes to add a whole group of people. Yes, ma'am?
Bob, ask what's going on. There's something that's going on. I've always had this question. There were several versions. What about variation? The name variation. How does that get appended to the name tag? I mean, it's sort of counterintuitive because you have nicknames and you have all other sorts of name tags.
Well, I appreciate it. It's counterintuitive view, but it's demonstrative of an overall philosophy that TMG is designed around, which is there is no right and wrong. Everything is evidence. So when people say this was his name, well, this was the name that somebody knew him as, or this is the name that he used at a certain phase in his life, but he also had other names which are just as legitimate and over the course of his life, or particularly she did, you know, because she had married names and that sort of thing. So it emphasizes and hopes to continue to remind you of dealing with your data as evidence instead of black and white, right and wrong kind of facts. As some programs, a lot of programs call them facts, or we deliberately go out of our way to not call them facts, because as much as we wish it were different, very little is black and white. Everything is a measure of evidence in your particular source. So a name variation is just one name that he went by. Now, the next step is to specify which is his primary name variation, and that one just shows up as a name up here. See this? It doesn't say name variation, name, adopted name, married name, whatever. It just says name. But it is just another name variation, and it's easy to switch from one to the other over time. You know, my, Bob is not my name, as far as my mother's concerned. And certainly not my name as, my, as far as my birth certificate is concerned and so on, but it is a name variation, a variation on how you would refer to me. So a lot of data reflects that. A lot of the labels that we use reflect that philosophy to remind you to treat your data as just a fluid gray area kind of thing that may very well change over time. And you're not making any you're not making decisions that can't be undone. Just real quickly there, back in the days of Roots 3, back when I was designing TMG originally, late 80s, I was using Roots 3. I never used Roots 2 or before. I know somebody that did here. There was a book that came out called Genealogical Computing with it was written by, I think, Dick Pence and Paul Andrack. Anybody go back that far? There you go. In it was a list of ideal features for genealogy software programming. And so I was all over that. I was going through, you know, checking them off. Okay, I got that one, I got that one. And like one of the top three things on the list was anything I enter, I should be able to edit later. And I was like, yeah, no kidding. But there were a lot of programs where you enter it, and I'm sorry, but you are done. You move on to the next person. Don't, there's no changing of your mind. There's no, you know, wavering on this. You've already entered that person's name. Go on to the next person. So, you know, that's early on. My grandmother taught me that nothing is right and wrong. Everything is gray, and everything is a measure of evidence, and you should enter it assuming that someday you're going to change it because you have other evidence that comes along. So that philosophy is pretty well ingrained in the program through terminology and labels, things like that. Longer answer than you wanted. Yes, sir?
Are F2 and F3 enabled for this screen?
Yes. Now, there's not much in here right now. Oops. My Mac. No, the function F2.
F2 expanded big list.
F2 is search, and F3 is repeat. So once you've done data entry and you're on a field, you can press F3 to repeat the values that you've previously entered. Or you can press Control F3, and that gives you a list of, by default, the last 15 things you entered in that field. So it's true here, and it's true on tag entry screens and everywhere else, that once you've entered some data, you can get, there's just not enough data in here already for me to bring up a list. This is, like I say, just installed yesterday. But F2 will give you a list of everything you've ever entered into this field. And it's different, of course. If you press F2 while you're on city, you're going to get a different list than if you press F2 when you're on state. F3 will give you the last thing you entered, so you can just F3 and go through to repeat a bunch of fields at once. Or Control F3 will give you a list of the last 15 things you entered in that field. And in the case of like place fields, where the fields are really connected, if you press Control F3 and you get that list, I wish I could show you, it will say city, county, state, and if you choose it, it will populate all three of those fields, or however many there are. So yeah, those are fast entry fields, and they work on the add person screen too, the new one. Yeah.
I have a question going back to the previous screen. How would you handle the Bob Robert? It's not a conflict, but, you know, most of your stuff you sign Bob, some document has Robert on it.
Well, I have to step back and give my usual waiver here, or caution. You're asking me how I would do it, so don't take this as how you should do it. Okay.
Well,
the program is called the Master Genealogist. Not because I am, but because it gives you the tools so that you can be the master of your data. We deliberately make a lot of different ways to do the same thing. And that contributes to the learning curve, I understand, but it also allows you to do things the way you're maybe used to from another program or the way it makes sense to you, record the kind of data that you want to and not what some program is telling you to. So, the program is designed to not preach to you about what's the right way to do things. And I would always say, if you get 10 professional genealogists in a room, you're going to get 11 ideas or opinions about the best way to do such and such. I have my own way of doing things, and people may or may not agree. So having said that, the question is, how would I enter the vote, or how would I enter my name? The way I do it is I enter the birth name, if I know it, as the primary name. So it would be Robert. I enter any name variations I encounter over time as they are referenced in that source. So if I'm looking at an education record and it says Bob, that's what I enter for his education. And when you go into a marriage, let's see here, John Alexander has multiple names. So if I were to go to add his marriage, this field over here on the right-hand side lets me choose, it doesn't have multiple names, oh, it's the wrong John Alexander. Sorry, let me go to his son, the other John Alexander, number one, and his marriage. On this right-hand side, I have a list of various names, the name variations that I've entered for him. I have a name variation of Frank, another one of Franklin, one of Reverend Frank, and one of B.F. Alexander. So when I enter his marriage, I not only choose him from the list, but I specify which name he used in that event according to this source. And among other things, that helps because the narrative reports honor this. So it will say, Robert, well, Frank Alexander was born, blah, 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 Reverend Frank was married, and Franklin was buried, if that's the way I configured it, because the tombstone says Franklin. So it helps narrative reports to make sense, especially like for women, and they're, you know, Jane Smith was married, and then Jane Smith had these children. Well, no, it was Jane Brown by the time she had those children. So that's the value in having multiple names. Every name I encounter, I enter. And I enter it the way I see it in that source. So, in fact, Reverend Frank is a good example. Let's go to, again, B.F. Alexander is listed among the names here. And that's because on his list, if you look here, here's the name variation. This is his primary name, Frank Alexander. Franklin Alexander, name variation, B.F. Alexander. If I go into that, that name, B.F., is associated with a particular source, Marriages of Carter County, Tennessee. And as the note says, Carter County Marriage Record is the only place where I've seen this name spelled this way. And it's, you know, some of the family think it's Benjamin Franklin Alexander, but I've never seen it written that way. I see it as B.F. Alexander. I wouldn't type out Benjamin Franklin unless I saw it in a source that way. And in the meantime, I specify what source I saw it spelled with these abbreviations, and I explain my theory is that the clerk who recorded the marriage record probably confused him, Frank, with his father-in-law, who was Benjamin Franklin Keebler. Okay, so now, the fact that I've entered these name variations doesn't mean they're going to show up necessarily in any kind of output. So, I mean, there are lots of ways for me to suppress that or to control what goes in a report. So, personally, I enter everything that I come across, every scrap of data I come across, every variation of that data I come across, I enter with my source, you know, time permitting anyway. And then I let it sort out in the end. You know, you never know which of those little scraps of information 5 years from now may prove critical. And so I record everything, and I handle the question of what's output as a separate question. One of the limitations of a lot of software, which, and I don't know that it's necessarily the software, I'm not criticizing the software, but it does encourage a mindset of, I want to enter this data because this is the way I want the report to look like. Yeah. This is the way I want the report. And then you find yourself compromising your data entry for some administrative purpose in order to generate a report in a certain way. So we go out of our way to separate those objectives. On the one hand, we want you to enter the data as faithfully as you can, or as faithfully as you want to, without worrying about the effect it's going to have on your report, because there are lots of ways to control if and when that data shows up in a report. So one thing that makes me cringe more than anything is somebody will say, I imported the data yesterday and I generated a report and it doesn't have, you know, I entered five people and the report doesn't look the way I want it to. So should I go back and change the way I did the data entry? I'm like, oh man. Focus on data entry and then focus on reports. Don't go immediately diving into reports and thinking that you should change the way your data entry is done. Again, I know a lot of software encourages that sort of thought process, but it's inevitably going to compromise your data entry and the faithfulness with which you record your evidence. Okay, so as usual, I went way beyond your question. Okay, I think this hour, the 10 to 11 hour, is supposed to be questions and answers, right? So feel free, other questions. Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering why we have to copy text into a copy tag and ask you whether you want
to
copy the tag.
Then
you have to say this.
Why you have that nag?
Yeah.
Well, I don't have a good answer for that, except that most of these nags have an option to disable it. I noticed this one doesn't, so I'll add it for you. That'll make you happy. Do you do that a lot, copy tags?
Yes,
the purpose of which is what? What are you copying, really?
Well,
you go back in and change something, right?
Yeah.
But what are you not changing? What are you finding useful to copy across?
Well, I have a format set up for my research, and so I can copy the tag, and then I know what things change without having to remember.
Well, I mean, are you copying places?
No.
Memos? Source citations? I know it will copy everything, but then you go back and change. And what are you not changing?
Not much. I mean, sometimes the date is the same.
The research tag?
Yes, the research
tag. It's literally called research, that's the label?
It is, yeah. And you know, if I'm doing a lot of research in a day, then I won't have to change the date.
So, do I understand you can say that it's just faster to say copy than to find it in the list? Mm-hmm. Is that?
Well, and because I have the memo is set up with a certain format.
The memo. Okay, so you're using multiple memo segments?
No, it's just it's set up to be like what I'm looking for with a semicolon and then what I found, semicolon. There's a format to my memo, and I want to keep that format.
Okay. I'm not judging you. I'm just trying to understand. It sounds as though you're using the memo in a sort of research task way for the research tag.
But it's yeah.
Do you use the research log?
No.
Okay, interesting. Just making a note, turn off copy tag, nag. There's a whole screen on the preferences screen to turn off these various nags about you didn't enter your sources, you didn't enter your citations, whatever. Most of those can be turned off. That one can't, but I'll fix that for you. Yes, Janice?
Any particular tips on moving your project from 7 to 8 that you're seeing in the report desk when people call and say, I do.
Well, most of the problems moving your data from version 7 to version 8 are from people who don't follow the instructions we give them, which principally the idea is you want to back that up in version 7 and restore it in version 8. You don't want to just copy the files over, and you don't want to just navigate in version 8, find your version 7 project and open it, because it's going to update it and now you can't get to it from 7. Or worse than that, you uninstall 7, and depending where you put your data may be gone too. So, no, now there is one thing in 801 that, and there may be more than that, I'm not remembering, but if you back up your data in 7 and you don't include all of your images in the backup for whatever reason, and you restore it in 8 to a different location, those images that you backed up will be saved in that new location. The ones that you didn't back up, the records are still in there, just the image wasn't in the backup file. The path to those exhibits will also be changed, which should not be the case. So, for instance, some people save their images on a CD or DVD or an external drive of some type, and when they make the backup, that drive doesn't exist. It's not plugged in, or CD is in the drive. And then they restore it in version 8 and say, restore it to this other folder. Well, those images that were internal or that were available to the backup are in the backup file, and they will go to the new location, but in version 8, those references to images that were on the CD will also have their path changed to that new location. So that's, well, it's a bug. It's a kind of a esoteric thing, as many of them are, but we did find some people that were doing that and got themselves in trouble, because now when you go looking for that image, it's looking on drive C/something instead of on your CD drive. If the image was there, then you're not going to have that problem. This applies to images that are not available to the backup. Nothing else dramatic is, nothing else that applies globally comes to mind in terms of the process of copying from version 7 to 8. But what we say, I think, pretty emphatically during the process and on our website is don't try to use a version 7 project in version 8 if you expect to go back to version 7. And some people naturally want to try version 8 until they're confident that it's stable and that their data is good and everything. And in the meantime, they want to have 7 as a fallback position. Well, that's fine, unless you tell version 8 to open up that data. And then you're really pulling the rug out from under the program of version 7, because it can no longer access that data. The project structure changes from 7 to 8, and the data is updated from 7 to 8 and is no longer available to 7. That copy of it. Now, you can have two copies. That's the point of backing up and restoring. When you restore to a different location. Now you have two copies. And now, the other thing that we say about the import process on our website is, if you have that mirrored situation, version 7 in your project, version 7 in a copy of your project over here, don't start doing data entry on both of them. Because then they get out of sync and the program doesn't know that you've got another copy of it over here. Just decide where you're going to do data entry and do your data entry there, and you're fine. It's just that, and more often than not, people who do that don't realize they're doing it, and so it's just something to be aware of. If you've got two copies of the project, make sure you're using the right one before you do your data entry. Make sure you know whether you're using version 7 or 8, because of course they look almost identical. But you don't want to get yourself in a situation where some of the new people are over there and some of them are over here, and then you've got to export them and merge them, and it's a mess.
Have you looked at Terry's tip on updating to 8? Does that describe the process pretty well on recommendations and stuff?
I looked at an early version of it and gave him some feedback. I haven't seen it since then, but yeah, Terry.
At least he said it's not to check back preferences.
Not to back up preferences?
Yes.
During the backup process.
During the backup of your 7 projects.
Yeah.
In
all likelihood, the preferences are going to change, yes. Now you can set them again, but I don't know. The defaults in some cases are different than they were in 7. I'm not sure I know of any disadvantage to bringing them across, except that some of them may be honored and others not. Report definitions in particular. Format of them has changed too. So if you designed elaborate report definitions in 7, you're going to have to design them again in 8. Yes,
sir. I now understand that I can toggle back and forth between the version of I have in PMG 7 and the one I have in PMG 8. But did I understand originally that you had the idea that we could see both on the same screen?
Yeah, you can.
How do you do that?
Well, now I have the additional challenge of doing this on a Mac, but I'm now using the sample project, as you see in the title bar there. I'm going to go and open the Sorbo project, which is a separate one. Do I want to close the current project? If I say yes, it will just replace it. But if I say no, it's going to open a second instance of DMG. So now when I look at the taskbar down here, I've got 2 copies of DMG running. Now if you have a big enough monitor, or maybe 2 monitors, you could put 1 on each monitor, or separate the screen. It's not going to work really well on this very low resolution screen I have here, but I just took this out of full screen mode and resize this one over here, and I'm going to do the same thing with this one and resize this over here, and then I'll move this one over here, and I have 2 copies of TMG running in different projects.
Okay, great.
Now I guess I won't talk about data sets and projects, but since you all have had a meeting about it, but there's, in most cases, I'll just say this, in most cases, it's better to put multiple data sets in the same project rather than have multiple projects. You can open, I opened 2 different projects here, the sample and the Sorbo project, but I might have picked sample. I could open sample multiple times and set them side by side just like that. So it doesn't have to be in a separate project. And it's usually better to put your multiple data sets in the same project. If, for instance, you've got your data set, you're importing a GenCom file that Aunt Louise sent you, you have a choice. You can either import that as a data set in the current project, which means it's... Am I doing something? No.
Is the microphone hitting your lip?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. No, it's buzzing. I'll just stay like this. you have a choice of importing that GEDCOM file as a separate data set in your project, which then, now you have 2 data sets in your project. Your data and the stuff you've imported. There's still a firewall between them. So you haven't taken custody of that GEDCOM file. It's not mixed with your data. It's a separate subset of your project. And you can work on that distinctly. You can generate reports from that distinctly. You can import and export from that data set. You can delete that data set as a whole. None of that affects your data set, which is a separate subset. And in and of itself, it's completely independent. The alternative is when you're importing that GEDCOM file, you can create a new project and import that data set, import that GEDCOM file to a data set in a new project. Now you've got 2 projects, each with 1 data set. And it's perfectly legitimate, and as I said, I try not to judge people how they may have a reason for doing that, and if so, fine. But for most people, it makes more sense to keep it all in the same project. For one thing, you're not opening and closing in order to see what you want. But you also have all of your data accessible to you, and you can do things when they're in the same project that you can't do when they're in separate projects, including, for instance, looking at an alphabetical list of everybody in both data sets, with people all mixed together. These are my people, these are the JEDCOM people. Alphabetically, they're all together. In fact, I'm going to close this one. And I'm going to switch to one which has two data sets in the project. And before I do, just want to point out that people have numbers. As you know, Frank is 1, John is 10, Delilah is 11. When you open a project that has two data sets, the ID numbers are a little different. Now they're preceded by a data set ID. There's data set number 1, person 1, data set number 1, person 10, data set number 1, person 11. And then there are a whole bunch of people that have a 2 in front of them. And when you look at the alphabetical list, I'll try to find a screen where I can see some of each. Oh, no, I'm just looking at the one here. There. So now I can see all of my people and all of the people I imported from Aunt Sally or whoever, the JEDCOM file, all in one alphabetical list. Now, they're not merged. There's still two separate data sets. Sorry. Yes, that must be it. They're still separate data sets in this project, but I can see them all at once. I can generate reports that include people from both data sets. I can generate a list of people born in Virginia and died in Tennessee across data sets. What I can't do is relational kind of reports. Because they're independent, I can't generate a pedigree chart that would ever include people from both projects, both data sets, because those people are not connected. They might be related in a historical sense, but as far as the program knows, they're completely unrelated subsets to your project. So that's usually a good thing. Now, again, having the opportunity to see them all together like this or generate some reports with everybody on it, you may very well say to yourself, well, here's Frank Alexander, born 3 October 1838. He's person number 1 in data set number 1. He died 13 November 1925. He had a father named John and his mother named Mary, or Delilah. And here's another one. Here's Frank, number 8 in data set number 2, with all the same data, so they're likely to be the same person. You know, this may be a JEDCOM file I downloaded from the internet somewhere, and I'm looking for some line that I want to be able to pick up. Well, I would probably never notice otherwise if I didn't see it in this sort of context. And then I could say, okay, now I want to take that data set and import it into, or rather merge it with my data set if I want to do that. Or I might extract a subset of data set number 2, which just has Frank and his ancestors. Make a new data set out of that. Now I've got 3. And now merge 1 and 3. And then delete 2. Everybody understand where I'm going? So there are a lot of advantages to having multiple data sets in the project. Not a lot of advantages having multiple projects, unless they're truly unrelated and never will have any chance of having a connection between them. Professional genealogists do use multiple projects, one for each client, for instance, and you're researching in one country and then you're researching in another country and you just don't think there's going to be any overlap, and if there is, you don't care anyway because the client's not interested in that, whatever. Then you might have multiple projects. The only other reason, the only other strong argument for having multiple projects is when having multiple data sets would mean you've got 300,000 people. You know, then it's going to slow your system down potentially depending on your hardware. But if size is not an issue, then it's usually better to have multiple data sets in one project. You can always, as I did here, filter so that I'm looking at only those people in data set one or only those people in data set two. And I can also go to the file menu and choose data set manager. And here they're both listed, my two data sets in this project. And I can highlight this one and disable it. And now I go back to the program and nothing I do is going to pull up a person in data set number two because it's completely disabled as far as the program is concerned. So, again, a lot of people do that with the idea that I don't want to have to see it. Well, you don't have to. You can just disable it if you want to. On the day you do want to see it, it's there and available to you. Okay, enough of that. Another question? Yes, ma'am.
If you're running TMG on two different computers, do you have a recommended way to keep them in sync?
Are they on a network?
Yes.
Home network?
Yes.
Yeah, when you open the project, well, on one data set, call it the host, because that's where the project is going to be, on that, on your computer. Your spouse has another computer, in the example I'm making up. He runs TMG, and when he says open a project, he's going to point to your computer on your folder and that project. So the data set is going to be read over the network. So there's still just one copy of the project. And the two of you can be editing it at the same time. You just can't edit the same record at the same time. But that's the best way of not of making sure that things stay in sync because you're only working on one project. If you were to copy it, and for people who don't have a home network, for instance, and still want to do this, or if you're corresponding and you've got multiple researchers around the country, and you've got to work with copies of the project, you just make a backup and send the copy to Louise in Kentucky, then she's going to be doing data entry, and you're going to be doing data entry in the same project, and now what do you do? You know, once a month or once a year, you're going to say, Louise, send me your project, and probably the best way to do it is to export only those people that have changed since a certain date. You can filter it that way. Mm-hmm. There is...
I don't know how to do that whole thing that from the very beginning.
Yeah, well, you said... Well, being... Explain that to us.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, from your standpoint, everything is exactly the same as the host, and that is the project is on your computer, it's on your hard drive. For him, it's going to be a little different. When he goes to open the project, he's going to say file open, and then he's going to navigate around to your computer. It's going to say down here, your computer, and then he's going to navigate to your C drive and your data folder, wherever it is, and pick the PJC file that he sees. So at that point, he's accessing your project across the network. Nothing's changed for you. And in fact, nothing, aside from this process of initially opening it, nothing's going to be different for him. But it's possible that his could be minutely slower, but probably not. Because he's reading the data across the network, whereas you're just reading it off your hard drive.
Will it automatically update?
It's not a matter of updating because you're working on the same copy. There's only one. So it doesn't need to update, it doesn't need to synchronize or anything else. It's as though he was sitting right next to you and you had two keyboards on the same hard drive.
Or you're going to put your laptop and you're going on away from that network.
Well, when you unhook your, if it's a laptop, and leave the house, you've got your data with you. If he does that, he no longer has access to the data because it was accessed through the network. So he might want to make a copy of it when he goes on the road, being careful not to do data entry until he gets back. Hold on just a second, that's generated lots of questions. Stanley?
On that same line, a number of the antivirus programs, unless you deliberately override it, will not let you look at the C drive from those computers.
Well, Stanley's saying that some virus checkers won't let you access data on another computer. It's true that virus checkers do, some of them have that option, but the network itself has features that might restrict that. So it has a lot to do with how your home network is set up. The typical way home network is set up, you can access folders on each other. So there, or at least there is a folder called shared, and if you put the data there, anybody on the network can access it. So when you say you want to create a project, or when you import a project and ask you where to save it, you'd say, save it in my shared folder so that other people on my network can get access to it. Not access for copying, although they could do that too, but I want them to be able to directly edit my project over the network so that there's none of that synchronization or anything necessary.
And that's a wonderful problem to have a backup and restore.
Well, it, among other things, yes, the backup and restore is simpler because she's the you might think of her as the owner of the project, whereas the husband is just has permission to access it. But everything that she does in terms of backing up and restoring, you know, is working on that project. He can still back up and restore it, but he doesn't. You don't want to have him open a copy of the project, because that's when you have to start worrying about synchronizing. You want him to open the same project, the same copy of the same project, but over the network on the other, on the host computer.
Sometimes we're in a situation like mine where I don't have an interested spouse in what I'm doing, and I just have the laptop and the desktop. The desktop is basically the home.
Yep.
And but when I'm on my laptop, I come up with ideas where I want to make edits, and so it's a drag going back and forth through the backup and restore process. So yep. I could be able to share between my laptop and my desktop, right?
Yes, and
or do I just use my laptop as a and go into the version that's on my desktop?
Well, that's what sharing is.
Well, it wouldn't be the other way around, in other words.
Well, the question you have to decide is where you want the data to be stored,
right?
On the desktop or on the laptop.
Right.
Understanding that when you unhook from the network, it's going to be available to one and not the other.
Right.
So if you unhook the laptop and you go on the road and you want it with you, save your data on the laptop, and on your desktop you're going to say, open the data on my laptop, that is on my laptop. Once you take your laptop and go, if there's anybody home that wants access to the data, they're not going to be able to because you've got it. Right?
Okay. Is all this explained on help somewhere?
Well, not as much as that. I mean, it talks about the issues and how to do it.
That's
not
the
energy
question. That's how you...
It's a networking question.
Okay. Would you have to install the TMG program on both?
Yes. The program has to be installed in both places, but there's only one copy of the project. And the program can be installed on up to three computers under the license, with the idea that you and your spouse are not both running it at the same time. Now, there's no physical restrictions to that, but if you want to be fair to us and two people are using the software at the same time, you'll buy a second license. But the idea is, I want to install it on my desktop and on my laptop and my computer at work that has a good printer. It's all the same to me, but for you it might not be. you can install the program in up to three places for your use. You can use it one day and your spouse the next day and back and forth and on one project, on one license. But if you're going to be doing this, what we've been talking about, where you're accessing the same project, you're both using the program at the same time, you should have two licenses. Wait a minute, Stanley, there was a question back here.
Couldn't you use a Dropbox or a service like that?
You could.
Maybe that resolves some of these networking issues, and if one system is shut down, you could...
I don't know maybe as much about Dropbox as you do, but... I don't think you can access directly on Dropbox, can you?
Sure.
You can open a project that's stored on Dropbox?
Sure.
Yes.
Yep.
But there have been some cautions on the TMG list from the computer gurus saying that, maybe it works for you now, but because it's a relational database and you have to worry about whether it's going up and down on the cloud, you run the risk. You've increased the risk of corrupting your database by doing that.
Well, again, it's a networking concept, yes. When you're working on a network, you've got multiple connections to the same project. If one of the connections goes bad or is flaky or gets disconnected in the middle of a save, then, yeah, something could go wrong. But, yeah, if Dropbox, if you can point, if you can go through TMG's file menu and say open a project which is stored on Dropbox and somebody else can do the same thing, then that's terrific. I need to look into that more.
Dropbox is on your folder.
It's like a virtual folder.
That's by the location, so it's actually physically on your drive, and then it just syncs to the cloud, and then your other computer syncs to that same cloud.
Can you specify the frequency with which it syncs? Or does it sync with every save? Every save? Or like every hour?
It actually does it during the while you're doing it, and then at the end when you close it, it finishes syncing. But you better not turn your computer off before it finishes syncing.
Right. I said that you can share a project across a network. What you can't do is edit the same record at the same time. Now, I clearly don't know Dropbox as well as I should, but as networks go, you increase the risk that you're going to be able to overcome that somehow, that you're going to manage somehow because of synchronization or lag time or connection speed or something else, you're going to manage to open the same record at the same time and somebody's going to lose what they entered. It's probably low risk, and Dropbox may have managed that somehow to make it no risk at all. I don't know. But you do add some level of risk by sharing a project, even if it's on the same network, same in-house network, but especially when you get connected over the internet. Maybe not enough to worry about. I don't mean to overemphasize it. It's just that you're adding other variables to the management of your project when you do that. Hold on, Sandy. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have any suggestions for somebody who's in the market for a new computer?
Yeah. No, I wouldn't necessarily buy a Mac. I just, on the cruise, John Cardinal was using a Mac for his demonstration, and I've seen it. I've used little. Dick Easton runs CMG on a Mac, and I've heard other people that do it. And I thought, how many, was anybody here on the cruise this year? Last year, 2011? Well, 5 minutes after my demonstration, my computer crashed. And it's still limping along, but it doesn't. Sound doesn't work, and the driver for the CD doesn't work, and the power management doesn't work, and so I had to buy a new computer. So I thought, well, maybe this is the time I should buy a Mac. Most of what I do is still on the PC side. For those of you who don't know Mac, there's a program called Parallels under which you can install a full copy of Windows, and there you can run any Windows program. It's not a matter of emulating. You're installing a fully licensed copy of Windows, but then you can tab over and use Mac programs. And there are some Mac programs I've heard about, especially if you're into graphics design and that sort of thing. Macs are really common for that sort of use. And so when I do projects that, I'm making a brochure or a sign or something out like that, but design people or the print shop that I'm sending it to always wants it in a Mac format. I'm like, I don't know. So I decided it was time to do it. I'm slowly venturing over to the Mac side and experiencing a little of that at the time, as much as I can digest at a time. But most of what I do is on PC. But it costs more. It's pretty substantially more to buy. Well, you're buying a full copy of Mac, and then you have to buy a full copy of Windows.
Which Windows have you got?
This has Windows 7 Home Premium on it.
And
Parallels, which you have to buy. And you have to, now I don't say this with authority because if anybody who knows better, pipe up, but this has 8 gigs of memory on in this machine, and I have to allocate some for the PC and some for the Mac. There may be some way to make it share, but right now the Mac version has 4 gigs and PC has 4 gigs. So I'm paying for 8 gigs, but I'm mostly using only 4 at a time. So, you know, economically, it's not the best choice, probably. But anything you buy now is going to run TNG just fine. You know, $200 laptop you can buy at Staples will run TNG just fine. Better than, you know, most of the, anybody who has a computer that's 4, 5, 6 years old or more is going to have a lot more trouble. Or it's going to be a lot slower. Anything you buy now is twice as fast as anything you can buy 2 years ago. And about the same price. Anyway, if you want more advice than that, feel free to email me or catch me before we leave. Hold on just a second. Stanley's been waiting.
This whole idea here with the things in the computers is brand new to me.
I'll investigate Dropbox more and write a newsletter article about it.
And
I need to learn more about it. So.
And if my memory serves me correctly, in maintenance file preferences, current project options, there are 7 or 8 different locations of files. Am I in the right place? Want your exhibits or you want your projects stored?
Yeah.
Do you have to change those if you're going to be sharing between computers on a network?
Well, you don't, but somebody who's sharing, in my case, let me find them. This is the location of where my backups go. This is where my configuration files are saved. This is where my exhibits are saved and so on. So I can change this. They're set automatically when you create the program. Now, if this happened to be in either my folder called shared or one which I configured to be accessible over a network, make it shareable. The shared folder is automatically shareable, but I can make any folder shareable if I wanted to. Then, if you and I are on the same network, yours isn't going to say see users administrator documents. Yours is going to say Bob's laptop /users/administrator or something. So the path is going to be different for me than it is for you, because I'm hosting it and you're accessing it as a client, what they call a client.
But they're both going to update. They're updating the same database.
They are the very same. You're using the very same copy of the project I am.
So
there's no updating or syncing necessary.
So when you take your notebook off at Timbuktu and you come back and access it with your desktop at home, you're accessing the one that you changed in Timbuktu.
Yeah. Well, if in your example the project is stored on your desktop and you're accessing it with your laptop, then you go off to Timbuktu, you have no access to your data because it's back home on your desktop.
Oh, okay.
If the data is on your laptop and the desktop is the one accessing it over the network, then you take your laptop to Timbuktu, you have your data, but whoever's at home doesn't have access to it anymore. Now, Dropbox or some other feature like it, some other service like it, from what I'm understanding, you have a copy of the project, I have a copy of the project. As each of us make changes, those changes are automatically sent to a server which has a third copy of the project. And it automatically synchronizes what you're doing and what I'm doing into the same project. I've got a copy, you've got a copy. I guess the one issue worth investigating is what happens if I get disconnected and I make changes to my copy. Then I plug back in, iCloud updates it, but...
Better off if it's only one person, but yeah, a bunch of people.
Well, I get this question all the time. I've got a family, a one-name project, and I've got 8 people who want to update the records. And they've got, you know, they're sending copies of projects, and then they're sending back subsets, and they're trying to merge them and make the connections and so on. If Dropbox would let 8 people access the project, that would be a big advantage to them, but if they, as soon as they disconnect from the internet, anything they add, I would say at the very least, is potentially problematic. And so, because then you enter into, well, is it going to synchronize what I entered yesterday because the changes haven't been yet sent, and what if he in the same time period edited the same record. It's going to try to sync them both. One of them's going to overwrite the other one. So as long as everybody stays connected when they're doing the data entry, that minimizes that problem.
The one time I did do it to myself is I came home after a research project with my laptop, and I guess I didn't have internet access at the end. So I came home and I didn't turn my laptop on to make sure it synced before I touched my database in on my desktop.
Right.
And then when I turned my laptop on, I'm like, it
was
created all for the
file.
So I've been very, very careful.
Yeah, you use Dropbox in the way I understood it, and which is, and I don't use Dropbox, but I use something similar, which every time I change anything, not just TMG, but anything on my computer, it syncs it through the cloud, through the internet, to a backup service. And so if I get struck by lightning right now, what I entered 5 minutes ago is saved somewhere else. And there are a bunch of services like this, Mosey, a bunch of others. It's online all the time. It's almost keystroke by keystroke. It syncs it to a server somewhere. Now, the part that I didn't previously understand is that somebody else could be syncing to the same copy over the internet from another location. And so that does open up possibilities for sharing projects.
And you can share your folders on Dropbox with other people. So
right.
You could arguably do that, but I was kind of scared. I had trouble just doing it myself.
Well, for most people, I imagine there are people wondering, you know, whether I really need to get into this. For most of you, you don't. There are people that run one-name studies, for instance, and it's a big enough issue for them that maybe it's worth doing this. Because synchronizing is always, you know, they spend half their time doing data entry and the other half synchronizing data entry somebody else does. So it might very well solve that problem, but they have to use it within certain restrictions and under certain rules to minimize the risk that something's going to get lost. Okay, moving on. Yes, ma'am.
Going back to the sharing, I have, if I start with 6. I put 6 on the desktop and I put 6 on TMG on, and of course I upgraded to 7 on my 7. But I have 7 on both of them on the laptop, and I'm the only one that uses it. But I was trying, does a flash drive work back and forth with 10 friends? If I made them a backup on the flash drive on TMG on the desktop. Okay. And then I put it in the desktop.
A flash drive is like a little hard drive. It doesn't have any moving parts, but it's when you plug it into your computer, now you suddenly have a drive B, which you didn't have before, or E, or whatever. So you could use it in two ways. On the one hand, you could put your project there and open it from your laptop. When you're done, close TMD down, close the project, take your thumb drive out, plug it into another computer, desktop, or whatever, open TMG, access that project. Now you've got one copy of your project, it's on your thumb drive, you take it everywhere you go, you can access it from any program, any computer that has TMG installed on it.
So that works.
Or, that works fine. Like anything else, you'd want to have backup somewhere so that old thumb drive, which might get lost or whatever, isn't your only copy. But that works fine. As long as, again, when you leave one and go to the other, you don't want to leave TMG running and just pull the thumb drive out. You want to shut the program down, which closes the project, then give it a few seconds to close everything, then take the thumb drive out. But the other thing you can do is, and again, it depends on your objectives, if you just want access to the project from your laptop, but you're not going to be doing data entry from it, you might just keep it on your desktop hard drive. When you make a backup, make your backup to the thumb drive, then go to your laptop, plug the thumb drive in to be able to access it. You know, my wife likes to walk around the cemetery with her laptop like this. Now she does it on her iPhone, but she doesn't do any data entry. You know, she just wants it for reference, and for that, you might have your reference copy on the thumb drive. Just don't do any data entry on that while you still consider the one on your desktop to be the master copy, the one that you're going to be modifying.
So now should I, I'm sorry.
You're sorry?
So when I go up to 8 and I'll restore them all both, like I did, just separately restore?
Well, which of those strategies are you using? You have your, where is your main copy of version 7? Data.
Desktop.
Your data. On your desktop?
But I have also on the...
Where do you do data entry?
On the desktop.
Okay. So when you want to update your laptop right now, you back up to something, a thumb drive maybe, and move it over to your laptop? Is that what you do?
Well, when I do it, I'm actually going to laptop.
Okay. So, yeah, nothing about that has changed from 7 to 8, or 6 to 8 for that matter.
Yeah, well, I'm
but, okay, so you'll continue to, you're still going to need to install the program in both places. You'll still want to back up the data from 7 and restore it in at least the desktop, but probably the laptop too. Just continue to consider your desktop as the host of your main copy. If you ever want to update your laptop, you can make another copy from your desktop, move it over to your laptop. Just be sure not to do data entry on your laptop, that's all.
So I don't need to just do it separately
and restore 8 on the laptop? Just do it on the... You could, yes. Well, you will. Initially, when you install version 8, you're going to want to restore it. You're going to back it up from 7 and restore it in both places. But only one of them, your desktop, is the one you're going to be modifying. The other one is going to stay unmodified. A month from now, a year from now, when you want to update your laptop, you'll take version 8, make a backup, take that backup over to your laptop, and restore it. Hold on, Janice. Yes?
I keep mainly on my desktop, but I also have the laptop, and whenever I update, I think I'm going to use my laptop and I'm on my desktop. I always use my flash drive. I do a backup. And then the next time I get onto my desktop, my laptop, then I do a system restore. And I restore it and they'll say, are you sure you want to overwrite this data? And yes, and it all restores. And then if I come here and I have to have my laptop and I may add some data, then when I get home, I copy it onto the flash drive and I go back and forth a lot because also I'm thinking about for me that sometimes my laptop doesn't work in some places for internet. It's like it's networked for internet only in my home. So I want to be able to use my laptop without having to be on the internet. But anyway, I do that as a regular basis. If I've updated my laptop, I'll save it, I'll restore, I back it up, and then I flash it on the desktop and restore it. Now, you could always sometimes forget to do it, but so far,
there's no harm done as long as you're not doing data entry in more than one place.
Oh, I do the data entry. In my laptop. I want to sit out on the porch or I want to sit on the balcony. I'm back at the patio. Then I'm going to enter it. And then I save it. I will go back up. And then I'll make sure that when I go
to
my laptop, and I just go back.
You just have to be religiously aware of where you've edited it.
That's correct.
And not do it both places. This is a thumb drive I carry with me. There's a copy of TMG. There's a copy of my data. You know, I don't edit it any place other than my laptop, generally. But if I do, I wouldn't install this one somewhere and start editing. I'd have to make sure, first of all, it's a faithful copy of my last edit on the desktop. Then I could edit if I want to, but I would staple a note to my forehead and make sure to copy it back again before I make edits back on the laptop again. Okay, there's, along these lines, yes, sir.
Windows XP, is there any problem with version 8
and Windows XP? Nope. My PC, which I have in my bag here, the one that's limping along, is XP. It was developed on XP for the most part and tested on a variety of operating systems. Yes, sir, in back?
Yeah, I upgraded to version 8, because I took a backup from version 7, so I'm loading it into version 8, and then you get when you're going while I'm restoring the project, it gives this window pop that says restore external web exhibits, and then you have a yes or no question.
Right.
So what's the significance of that? So that's your
Are you William Chapman?
You went over right.
Okay, that was the same scenario I have here, which I was about to read to somebody. It does ask you questions. Do you want to overwrite this and overwrite that? If you are, now let me frame this carefully. The most common scenario, I think, for this is if you, do you have more than one project?
No.
No.
But, no.
Okay, so you just backed up from 7, you restored it into 8, and it asks you, do you want to...
Yeah, it's a JPEG file.
Right. Exhibits, you have the option when you restore to specify where your exhibits are going to go. And if you choose the same path that they are already stored on, and accept access from 7, then every time it restores a file, it's going to find there's already one there by that name. So, if it were me, I would probably say no, I don't want to overwrite it, for two reasons. It's going to be faster, and it's going to minimize any risk that the backup and restore process created a problem. The original that's on the hard drive in that location, I know it's good, so why overwrite it? Now, there would be similar questions about when you have multiple projects about files that are shared across projects, like filter files or accent files, those sorts of things. And so if you back up a project and restore it, and then you back up another project and restore that in the second restore process, it's probably going to have a series of questions. Do you want to override this filter file and these accent files and so on? And again, I hesitate to make a rule because it might be different in your case depending on where you're storing things, but for most people, it probably doesn't matter how they answer that question because it's an exact copy of it in both projects. Janice?
One thing that happened when I did my restore, and I noticed it on the TMG list, when I first installed TMG 8, it would come up and freeze at like 20%.
On the restore process?
On loading TMG 8 after you install it.
After you've restored the data or installed the program?
I can't remember. It'll do it here. It's just opening the project.
Okay.
So they'll clean up the data set, and it freezes on 20%. With me, fortunately, my virus protection pops up and says, do you want to allow TMGA to access the internet? That seems to be what's freezing it. And as long as I check my little thing and allow it, it goes right on.
Well, the only time we access the internet that isn't related to a project is when you run the program for the first time, or not for the first time, when you run the program, and if you haven't changed the defaults, it checks what we call a message manager, which I haven't used recently, but I should. Anyway, it's a way for me to distribute a message. You know, if we had a really serious bug that I wanted everybody to be aware of, even if they didn't belong to a group or read a newsletter, I'd put that in what we call a message manager. And every time you run the program, if you have an internet connection, it checks to see whether there's any messages from Bob. I'm moving forward. Leave me alone. Maybe there's power right next to me.
Do you have a plan in your office or something?
I think it's just electricity next to me. Where was I? Oh, message manager, thank you. So what does happen to some people is, and especially if you don't have an internet connection, it will try for some time on that message manager. It'll keep trying, checking for messages from Bob. And you can do a couple things. You can disable that altogether, but then you won't hear from me. Or you can set a wider interval so it only checks every 10 days or every 30 days or whatever. If you've already restored the data, the restore process, when you're restoring project that was backed up in 7, the restore process includes a lot of processing to upgrade that project, and that takes time. It's possible that that project, you know, in the case of doing a restore, that process could take some time, depending on what kind of data, how many images you have, and that sort of thing. But once that conversion and upgrade of your project has happened, and the next time you open TMG, you shouldn't be experiencing that delay anymore. The only delay, typically, that you might encounter is the message manager or, well, then that wouldn't do it.
I can show you what happens. It happens every time I open up TMG 8. As long as my, you know, I've got a pop-up that tells me what's happening and why it's having problems with the patch and my virus protection is saying, do you really want to allow this?
Let me ask you this. If you are running TMG and you have a project open and you switch to the sample, does it happen again? Without closing the program?
Not we can show you this if you want.
Well, this will answer my question. You can tell me. That'll tell me whether it's a program-oriented feature or something related to the project that might be slowing it down. But in either case, except for the message manager, we don't do anything on the internet without your access for
us. What's happening is, unless if I didn't know, because the little thing pops up and tells me, do you want to let it go? Somebody else may have their inspection never tell them and just stop it.
I understand. And I appreciate you mentioning it. But if what the what the virus checker is saying is, do you want to allow this program to access the internet?
Yeah. And it's for messages.
It is from the message manager.
Yes.
Okay, so that should only happen when you load the program, and it's regardless of the project. And it shouldn't happen if you open a second project.
Of course, it's not
doing that. If your experience is consistent with that, then yes, it's probably the message manager. And if you're on a wireless, you're more likely to get that more of a delay than without it. If it's just unmanageable, you know, and a few people have told me it takes 30 minutes to get past that. So I would just say turn it off. It's not that. I feel like I haven't used it in 2 years, and it's there for really critical situations. But I did use it to say newsletters are out because we got messages from people saying, you know, you sent a newsletter and I didn't get a copy. So like Dick Eastman does, I started sending out messages saying, we just sent a newsletter. If you didn't get one, check your junk box. You know, that sort of thing. And I think I announced the last cruise on the message manager, maybe. But somebody, Clyde, I think, handed me this message from Bill Chapman. I'm just going to take it. We've covered it, I think, but I'll take it and I'll answer him by email. Clyde, I don't know where he went. The other written question here, let me just read it. Oh, it's William Chapman again. Asked about what to overwrite when restoring. Oh, it's the same question. Terry Regal replied, overwrite things that you think have changed that you want to keep, like report definitions. If you haven't customized the item, don't overwrite it to be sure you have the latest versions. You're saying like report definitions. And I said earlier that you weren't going to be able to copy the report definitions over, so maybe I'm mistaken, but a lot has changed in the report definition, so maybe a better way of saying it is the backup process allows you to choose, you know, do you want to include accents, do you want to include filters, do you want to include report definitions, and if you say yes and you copy them over to version 8, I guess maybe the better way of saying it is they may not completely work the way they did in version 7. You might find you have to tweak them some. But you might not have to restore them from scratch. I mean, recreate them from scratch if you copy the report definition over from 7. But don't do anything manually, and that's the thing that really gets tech support phones buzzing. Don't copy, you know, an FLT file from this project to that project, or, you know, this FPT file is bigger than that one, so I'm going to copy it over. You just have it for trouble. That's what the backup and restore process is. We've spent a lot of time developing and making sure that we get everything that you need. The TMG project is a relational database, so there's 30, 40, sometimes 100 files associated with your project, not counting exhibits. And we know where to find them, and we bundle them all together and put them in a backup file. If you try to copy manually, you're going to forget something, and it's just inevitable you're going to have problems. Johnny, tell me to shut up.
Well, I think we're supposed to be out here at noon and it's 5 after, so do you want to take one more call? Or
I was taking another question, sure. Yes, ma'am.
Jen?
After you transfer me, can you just delete stuff without a problem?
Yes. After you've installed, the program, restored your data over, you can uninstall version 7. I would get to know version 8 a little bit before you do that. There's no rush, no reason you have to do it right away. Some people find that it's easier to learn about the new features by comparing it to the way it used to work, and so they want to toggle back and forth. So just, yeah, you can uninstall it anytime you want, just don't feel a need to do it because the program doesn't care. And it takes up a little more space in your hard drive, but there are a bunch of little things, just checking to see what I've left out. Again, if you go to our website, holygenes.com, click on the link for TMG, the first link there is what's changed in version 8. And there's a lot of stuff I haven't talked about, but not major features. We've covered most of the major ones. Well, search from the web, that's pretty dramatically different. You go up to web and click on search the web. I can get this window small enough. Now you can search AltaVista and Ancestry and Bing and Family Search and Find a Grave and Fold 3, which used to be footnote, thank you. Actually, your copy in 8 says footnote. Mine, since this is 801, essentially, we changed it to Fold 3. They recently changed their name. So you can search all these websites at once. I think in version 7, there's how many, 3 or 4 things you can search. There's a whole lot more you can search, including Google Books and Google Images, Social Security Death Index, Yahoo, and so on. Is this using Roots Web? If so, that's broken.
Yeah.
Roots Web just terminated theirs, and if that's the one we're accessing, then that will have broken in the process. But there's half a dozen other places where the Social Security Death Index is available. Anyway, you can search all these websites at once if you want. You can specify which websites you want. If you're like me, I'll go on and I'll search Ancestry or I'll Google for a person's name. And then I'll see something interesting and I'll go off and I'll read about that and I'll forget to go back and search by the name variation or the married name or the whatever. So the nice thing about this is even if you just choose one site, you have a bunch of options as to what characteristics to search for, but you can also tell it down here in the bottom right to search only for the primary name, all the names for that person, all the names in the Project Explorer, all the names in the focus group. And so it's not going to forget to search for the name variations and the married names and everything. It's going to open up one browser window or tab, depending on that, your browser, for each of those searches. So even if you don't go back till tomorrow or the next day to go through those tabs, it's going to do every one of those searches without forgetting. And so, for instance, if you've ever searched Google for a person's name, you've probably seen lectures about searching on Google, but one of the things I see a lot of people do is they search for John Smith and they forget to go back and search for Smith, John, in quotes. Because a lot of databases are listed last name first and you would miss it if you didn't do that. So you'll see here, you've got checkboxes for each of these things. It will search, right now, it will search one site, the highlighted site, 5 different ways for the focus person. So there's a total of 5 searches, and sure enough, in the bottom left-hand corner, it says 5 total searches. If I tell it to search all enabled sites, of which there are 3, with a checkbox, it's basically going to search this one for 4. It's going to search Ancestry 4 ways. It's going to search Family Search 1 way, that one 5 ways. I don't know what the math is, but it depends on the site. Because different sites have different ways of searching, but if you look in the bottom left, it's going to tell you it's going to do 10 total searches. If you search all 16 sites by all the names of the person, well, that's 252 searches. So, again, enough rope to hang yourself with. It would warn you before that. There's a preference setting that says, warn me if I try to search for more than 100 or 10. Okay. Did we learn anything?
Yes.
Thank you all. Nice to see you. Have a good trip back. I'll hang around for those of you who have specific project questions.